Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Project Zion podcast. This is Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history, and I'm your Cup of Joe host, Karen Peter. Today's episode is a collaboration with Community of Christ Historic Sites as we interview the presenters from the 2020 Historic Sites Summer Lecture Series. And these lectures can be found at historicsitesfoundation.org. Our guest today is Wendy Eaton. Wendy works at the Joseph Smith Historic Site in Nauvoo, Illinois. Hi, Wendy.
Hello.
Welcome back to Project Zion. It's good to have you with us today. So your lecture in the Historic Sites Summer Series is titled Stories Behind the Preservation of the Joseph Smith Historic Site in Nauvoo, Illinois. Now you work at this site in Nauvoo, so let's start there. Tell us a little bit about the site, kind of an overview of the Joseph Smith Historic Site.
Joseph Smith Historic Site spans the southern 40 acres of the peninsula of the town here in Nauvoo. So we are surrounded by the Mississippi River here. It's a beautiful location. We care for 19 buildings, both the physical care and preserving the stories of the buildings as well. Five of those are open to the public, typically, not this year, but that would be the Homestead Mansion House, Red Brick Store, and the Visitor Center, with the Nauvoo House kind of as a special addition. Some people get to go in, but since we use it as a rental facility, we're not able to take every tour into that place. Probably the most visited place on site would be the Smith Family Cemetery, which is still open to the public. So if people do choose to visit Nauvoo in this year, they really shouldn't be traveling. But if they do show up, they can go in and look around the cemetery. There is some work being done in the cemetery right now. They are replacing the fence this week. So that's been fun to watch happening, the ongoing preservation here.
So having been to Nauvoo and the Joseph Smith Historic Site many times, it is a wonderful experience to visit and to go through the five buildings that are open. I have my favorites of all of them, along with my favorite stories from the tour. So I'm really excited that we're talking about it today. So in your lecture, you tell several stories from the site, and you do a very clever thing, and that is you share through the lens of one individual as kind of the tour guide for your lecture about the site. And the person that is your narrator is Vida Smith. So who is Vida Smith, and why did you kind of talk about the site through her lens?
Vida is fascinating. And I have to say that I haven't paid a lot of attention to her until recently. I've been doing a little investigation in the last couple weeks since my lecture, just to find out a little bit more about her. She was born in 1865 in room number 9 of the hotel wing in the Mansion House. She's the second child of Alexander and Elizabeth Smith. So Alexander would be one of Joseph and Emma's children. Vida is either the 6th or 7th grandchild of Emma. I'm not exactly sure where she falls in the line, but one of the first 10. Most Community of Christ members would be familiar with Vida as a hymn writer. She is the one who wrote There's an Old, Old Path.
Yes.
And so most people, again, that's how they're going to know her, but she wrote so much more than that hymn and other hymns that she wrote during her life. She wrote for a number of the different church publications, especially for youth and for women. There was a magazine called Autumn Leaves that she wrote for that was specifically geared at youth. She wrote 2 volumes of church history for youth that were published in 1914 and 1918. And 1918 is the year the site here in Nauvoo officially opened as a historic site. probably in some of the preparation for that publication, that two volumes of church history, she visits Nauvoo, and she comes with her husband. I won't get into too much of him. His name is Heman Smith. He was the official church historian for some time. But as Vida's visiting here, she writes her memories of childhood as she's viewing the grounds and the homes that is so connected with her family. And I know you're not supposed to let your bias show when you are presenting history, but I'm going to be very upfront. My bias of history, I'm not a wife or mother. And so often, unless you really dig, that's how women are painted in history, is either a wife or a mother. Vida is both, but when she is writing in Autumn Leaves of this particular visit to Nauvoo, she's in the mindset of reporting how it looks, but then thinking back to her childhood with her grandmother, Emma. And that is a role that I could connect with. I am a granddaughter. I have a grandmother that I think very highly of, who lives up in Maine. And when Vida writes of Nauvoo and her childhood, it's completely intertwined with Emma, her grandmother. And I have the same feeling when I think of my grandmother and Maine and the family history that I have up there. So finding this document of Vida's really helped give me the feminine voice that I was missing in the previous research that I had done. There are women voices in church history. Sometimes they take a little digging to find, but so often it's male voices talking about the activities of men. So I was really happy to find this document of Vida's. It really helped me connect more with the story I was hoping to share.
Oh, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the sites that Vida writes about and that are part of the Joseph Smith Historic Site, for which the church is responsible for preservation. Let's start out with the homestead, because that's kind of the first building that we go into on the tour. It's kind of where things start. So let's talk about that.
So with the homestead, and since my lecture was the development of the site, I thought I should probably address a little bit of the property ownership in Nauvoo, even though that's not my favorite subject to talk about, but it's pretty significant. Back in 1839, when the church is settling Nauvoo, they don't have a lot of finances, and so they have to purchase a lot of the land and the existing buildings, such as the homestead, on credit. And Joseph Smith, as president of the church, is also trustee in trust for the church, so all of this purchasing and use of credit is under his name, which ends up being a problem for Emma. When he dies, there is so much confusion over who owns what. And this isn't just on personal levels. You hear about the strife between Emma and Brigham Young, but there are state conflicts between Missouri and Illinois and even the federal government over who owes who money over the various different purchases. It's somewhere around 4,000 acres of land and a riverboat that Joseph Smith and the church has accumulated debt over, that they turn around in the years after his death to have to try to figure out who's getting what. And I try to be pretty fair-minded when I look at this, because it's very easy as a community of Christ to completely sympathize with Emma in her struggles. She sees these as her homes. She wants them for her children. But Brigham Young is also leading a church. They have finances that need to be resolved. They need money to make a trip west. And so you just get all this legal strife and financial strife happening here in the city. After Brigham Young heads west, Emma ends up embroiled in about 12 years of legal battles before she finally has ownership of what we would consider the core of the historic sites, including the homestead and mansion house and several of the other homes that are here. it's just kind of a testament to her sticking it out in the long run to deal with 12 years of legal battles with all this conflicting property issues. It's crazy, it's complicated, but it's significant that she is able to hold out and obtain the property that she does so that her children can inherit. Because as they grow and their children inherit the properties, now you're suddenly in the 1900s and we're developing the historic site. So it's easy to reach that transition of going from family properties to a historic site that's open to anybody to come visit. Your other question's a lot more fun with property dealings, and particularly with the homestead. The homestead itself is where Joseph Smith spends most of his life here in Nauvoo, but it's also very much the beginnings of the family home here. And you get history of two different Latter-day Saint churches finding their beginnings in Nauvoo here. Of course, the overall larger Latter-day Saint tradition, but then Community of Christ as well. Because when Joseph III grows up, he inherits the home, and he is running his church from this home before he agrees to move elsewhere. It's a charming little house. I would not want to live there today, but it's a well-preserved structure that has so many great stories in it. And one of the things I talked about in the lecture, and if you have a chance to go watch the lecture, you really should, because I show a lot of images of the site and I show a picture of a violin. So when I started with historic sites in 2006, part of that summer was spent with artifacts. I was at Kirtland Temple and I was spending a lot of time in the basement of the temple measuring stonework and looking at different artifacts that I would never have thought of as artifacts. But it gave me an appreciation for what is that tangible evidence that has been left behind through history. And so as I was looking for something completely unrelated in the attic of the visitor center here in Nauvoo this last winter, I saw a violin sitting up on the top shelf. And I pull it down and I brought it out to where I could get a better look at it. And inside of the violin, there's a maker's label, and it reads, made by Frank Carroll, Nauvoo, Illinois, year 1927, of wood taken from the residence of Joseph Smith, the prophet at Nauvoo. And so I pretty quickly went from handling it with my bare hands to putting on curator gloves to handle this piece, because not knowing quite what the significance was of it at the point. But I started doing a little extra research on it. And in a February 2nd, 1927 Saints Herald article, I find that Frank Carroll had given this piece to the historic site and it became part of the collection. There was remodeling being done the previous year in the homestead to make it so that guests could come in and tour the space. They had to remove some of the wood, and they gave the piece to Frank, and he crafted this violin out of this piece of wood and then turned and gave it back to the site. And this is what I love so much about the artifacts. We know the Smiths were a musical family. Emma and her contributions to the various hymnals early in the church, her children and grandchildren like Vida writing hymns that are still being sung to this day. It's easy to make the jump to music being very much a part of family life there in the homestead. And so then to move nearly 100 years later to have a musical instrument created out of part of this home, it makes this connection with the family and music that you normally couldn't put your hands on. And just out of pure curiosity, I looked for some information on Frank Carroll, the violin maker. He's not a church member. I believe he's part of the Lutheran church here in town, but he is the son of German immigrants. I think he's born in Ohio sometime in the 1860s, and then his family moves to Nauvoo, which has a long Germanic history. And I don't know if he would have ever known Emma. There's a good chance he would have known who she was. She was greatly treasured in the community in her later years. But he grows up here, and the writings that have been left behind of Joseph Smith III, we know how much he treasured the immigrant community and cared for them, that there's a very good chance that Joseph would have been aware of the Carroll family, even if he didn't know Frank, because there's quite an age difference between the two of them. For then Frank to grow up and be a part of creating this instrument, I thought was pretty interesting. So you hit multiple levels of history with this one little piece, and the violin needs work. I mean, I don't know how to play a violin, but I know it can't be played in the condition it's in right now. But it was a lot of fun to find that piece just sitting up in the attic. It makes you wonder in people's homes what things they have just sitting around that they don't realize are sitting in their attics and need to be taken better care of or can help tell their own family stories.
That's a marvelous story and a marvelous gift from Frank Carroll to the historic sites. So we have that property, which is where things kind of started, as you talk about, and where the family first settled in Nauvoo, their first residence. But then if you go across the street from there, you go to what's called the Mansion House. So let's talk a little bit about what's transpired in the life of the Mansion House. It fell into quite a state of disrepair for a while and has taken in a lot of preservation effort. So let's talk a little bit about the Mansion House, which, by the way, when I first heard Mansion House, I was thinking something totally different than what I saw when I came to Nauvoo.
Well, compared to some of the other homes, it's a mansion. It's much bigger than some of the other homes here in the community. Joseph Jr. spends very little of his life in the Mansion House. It's so often that's the home that people associate with him. And I think it's because it's so grand compared to some of the other places here in the community, the historic places. And when I went through Vida's information, I loved what she wrote about the Mansion House. So I'm going to read that quote, even though I read it in the lecture, just because I like what she says and how she describes this. So just again, a reminder, Vida would have never known her grandfather, Joseph. She's not born until 1865. And so we are looking at the Mansion House as it would have been as a family home in the 1860s and possibly right up into the 1870s with the words that she has here. So Vida writes, "There was laughter and merriment in the big house, for the young delighted to gather there. One by one, the boys crossed the old stone step, each with a wife, until three daughters-in-law called Emma Smith mother. The first grandchild came into the family in the homestead. A remarkable little lady she was, with big brown eyes and quaint, dainty ways. Then the first grandson was brought home. Then the family circle became disturbed by a movement of some of its members. The church was reorganized, and memory of this past persecution lent fear to the future. Popularity began to wane. In the midst of this, the pall was spread in the mansion again, and while one dark-eyed son girded himself for the long, hard strife in his father's place, another closed his sunny brown eyes, and his mother wept that they opened no more. To comfort her, the poet's son David sang, 'It was then that my grandmother gathered up the one little grandson and whispered, I'm glad that he is named Frederick.'" There was so much emotion when I first read that quote that it spoke to me of, yes, this is a beautiful house. There's all sorts of incredible things that are kept inside of it. But this is a family home for a family who was in the midst of some major transition during the 1860s and 70s when Vida was a little girl. And so just to explain a few of the people, in case people aren't quite familiar, the dainty little granddaughter would be Joseph III's daughter, Emma Josepha was her name. The grandson is probably Vida's older brother, who is named Frederick Alexander. The disturbance in the family circle is a couple different things. For one thing, Vida's father, Alexander, and her uncles, Joseph and David, taking on leadership roles within the reorganization, and eventually those roles leading them to move away from Nauvoo. And so this family unit where Emma has wanted to just stick out the rest of her life is suddenly starting to move away. And then the other disturbance that they talk about, the sunny brown-eyed son, Frederick Smith, Emma's second son, had a terrible illness and he died in the mansion house. And this was 1862. Emma would eventually have two grandsons that are named for her son. I mentioned Frederick Alexander, Vida's brother, but then Joseph III would later in Plano have a son that he names Frederick Madison, who eventually becomes one of our presidents of Community of Christ. So there's a lot going on in the mansion house after what we think of with the 1840s time period. Alexander and David are sharing the mansion house and hotel. They both have wives. They both have children. They're raising their families in this space. Eventually, Alexander moves his family to Plano, Illinois, and then later to Missouri. David, during all his travels with his role in the church, he eventually experiences some mental decline, and the family has to make the difficult decision to have him institutionalized. Both of them, Alexander and David, have extended family who stay in Nauvoo. Alexander, it's a brother-in-law, so one of his wife's brothers, who stays in the mansion house and kind of takes care of things for him. David's wife, Clara, I believe it's one of her brothers, ends up staying here in the community. And I think they live in the Sydney Rigdon house, which is right next door to the mansion house. I have to do a little more digging on that one. But for Alexander, even though he's left Nauvoo, whenever he's back in the area, he visits family like any of us would, and he stays in this home of his childhood, and he's able to then keep an eye on how things are going here in the community with his mother and her declining health, and then eventually with the properties themselves. He's the one that really starts thinking about the long-term preservation of the historic sites and bugging the presiding bishopric about doing something with the site because he and his brothers don't have the money to take care of it, but the church really needs to step in and do something. So he's the one that really starts getting this idea of the historic site stirring in the broader church mind, even though the cemetery would eventually be the driving force to establishing a historic site. Alexander's at a church reunion in the area, not in Nauvoo, but not too far away, when he visits Nauvoo afterwards. This is 1909, and he takes ill and ends up dying in the mansion house, and then is transported to Lamoni, Iowa, and he's buried up there. Within 10 years of his death, that is when the major shift is starting of moving from family homes to historic sites. And as I mentioned, 1918 being the official date where we really did open as a focused historic site. With the mansion house in those first few years, initially the caretaker lives upstairs. This would be John and Ida Layton. And tourists are taken through the downstairs of the mansion house. But before any of this happens, you mentioned about the disrepair. In the later 1800s, so Alexander has moved away from Nauvoo. It's a return trip that he realizes. And hints from the community here in Nauvoo that the hotel wing is a mess. It needs to come down. It's a public safety issue. And so the mansion house as it stands today is probably about a third of the size that it would have been back in the 1800s. But so as the historic site is starting in 1918 and those first few years, as I mentioned, caretakers are living upstairs. One of the fun things I noticed, there's also accounts of couple staying over in the Nauvoo house, which I think would have a little more appeal than the mansion house. But anyway, it happened. It didn't happen for very long. By the 1950s, that was no longer the case. The caretakers were not living in the mansion house, and those honeymooning couples were looking elsewhere to spend their time together. There are numerous attempts at renovations and structural care throughout the 1900s. There's about a year-long push in the later part of the 1950s, but there's nothing major that happens to the mansion house until the 1990s. And they lift the entire structure off its foundation and they pour a new foundation and basement for the mansion house. It's then put back in place. And for the first time that I can tell, maybe it's the first time officially, tours are taken to the upstairs of the mansion house as well. Throughout its time, I would say 1940s into the 1950s, the mansion house at times serves as the visitor center for visitors, so that would often be the first stop that they make. And they have a little, they call it a church literature depot. So think of all the brochure racks that are in the lobbies of our congregations. That's kind of what I picture they must have had set up. And I think it was in Emma's kitchen that they had that set up in. So it's an exciting life that the mansion house itself has lived in its transition from family home to curator's home and tourist stop and to now fully being a tourist location.
And really, it's a very interesting structure to go through as part of the tour. So you mentioned that people are a little bit less familiar with the Nauvoo house. If I was going to honeymoon in Nauvoo, I'd much rather be at the Nauvoo house than at the mansion house myself. Although the Nauvoo house has kind of an interesting vibe to it as well. So why don't you talk a little bit about its preservation and first what it is, its preservation and how it's used now.
It's interesting that you say the Nauvoo house has its own little unique vibe to it, because that's very much, there are times that I can't stand the Nauvoo house. And then there are other times that I absolutely love the structure. And I think it has a lot to do with its original intention in the 1840s. It was to be a really big hotel. Joseph Smith and his family was going to have a suite of rooms in it. It was completely a place of overnight accommodation. That's essentially what it was. It doesn't get completed in the 1840s. It sits just a brick and stone shell for a number of years. It's Emma's second husband, Louis Weideman, who decides to preserve it in his own way by taking down the existing wings and completing the corner portion of the structure. He and Emma move in around 1871, and they call it the Riverside Mansion. And when I'm thinking kindly towards the Nauvoo house, that's what I think of it as. I think of it as the Riverside Mansion, and I think of it as Emma's home. Mm-hmm. And the significant moments in her final years, she dies there, her funeral is held there. And when Vida thinks back to this home, so she would have been a little bit of an older child at the time of her grandmother's death, but she writes of the Nauvoo house or the Riverside Mansion, "It speaks to me of a beautiful personality that I have always felt within the deep old rooms." And so there's such a presence of Emma when you have yourself in the right mindset and you enter the building to focusing on Emma, that you get then when you're just going in to make sure it's clean and ready for the next rental group. So today we've gone back to calling it the Nauvoo House. Groups can rent it and stay there. We get a lot of family reunions, a lot of retreats that take place there. The John Whitmer Historical Association and Sunstone Nauvoo, they both kind of focus on the Nauvoo House. Some of the attendants for those conferences stay there. There are classes and meals that are held in Emma's parlor there in the Nauvoo House. And it gets to be today a huge variety of uses. And again, I think that's why I at times have such conflicting feelings about the building. There are times that I love the activities that are happening there. And then there are other times that, oh, this group didn't clean up after themselves. We've got 4 hours before the next group comes in. We've got to rush and get this ready for them. But it's an incredible building, and I appreciate that Louis Weideman did something with it. He's got a fun history. You could spend a lot of time talking about Louis Weideman, but the fact
maybe we'll do it. Maybe we'll do an episode on him sometime, Wendy. That would be fun.
But the fact that he decided to do something with this, and it was encouragement from his stepsons to provide a home for Emma to retire in, that he looks at doing something with the structure. But it's a fun building, especially if I remember to remind myself that it's a fun building and it's Emma's home. And it's important to me as well. I had spent several years in Kirtland as a guide, but I never came out here as a summer intern until my congregation had a retreat at the Nauvoo House in 2014. And I had arrived early with another to help with some of the setup and checking in. And Kristen Mackay, who's now the site director, she called me back to her office here in the visitor center. And she's like, "What are you doing this summer?" And she knew I was not employed at that point. And I'm like, okay, fine. I feel like I'm much too old to be an intern, but okay. And so I came to Nauvoo for the first time as a summer intern after having that weekend retreat with my congregation. So who knows what would have happened if my congregation hadn't decided, oh, let's go to Nauvoo for a weekend. It may have paved the way to help me get into the life that I'm living now.
True, and much better to go for the first time as a retreat than a honeymoon. So I'm glad that that was your experience. I'm not going to get over that, Lindy. I'm just going to be honest. Okay, so next, let's talk a little bit about my favorite building, and that is the Red Brick Store. I love the Red Brick Store for a couple of reasons. One, the way that it serves as a for people who visit the site to buy something to take home as a souvenir is just really sweet and is lovely. But upstairs at the Red Brick Store is probably my favorite place. It's the place that I am least happy about, the small office there, and the place I appreciate the most, the larger room, and the setting apart of the women for the Women's Relief Society. So let's talk about Red Brick Store.
Okay, so the original store opened 1842, and the structure exists until 1890, and then it's taken down. It had fallen into some disrepair. The brick was needed for other building projects, so they just took it down. For the 40 or so years in between, it's a pretty active location for the community. For the non-church side of things, it's a general store. Of course, it's not the only one here in town, but it serves that purpose. So 1800s, it's a gathering place for people to come and swap stories and hear the news. It acts as a civic center or a justice center as well. There are a number of different hearings that take place. You start to get into some of the church legal issues with that because there are some of the legal battles that Joseph Smith Jr. is involved in that take place there in the Red Brick Store in that upper room. But it's also a place of classrooms for children, social gatherings, like I mentioned. But there's a good document of a magic show being held in the 1840s. There's a traveling artist who puts his art on display up there. So it really is quite a multi-purpose space, that upper room. For anybody who's in the community. As far as the church itself, that upper space serves for church leaders to have room to gather and meet, including the little office that you mentioned. That'd be Joseph Smith Jr.'s personal office, one of his many offices. And Newell K. Whitney, as the bishop, he has an office in the downstairs location. but also for the church, the Relief Society officially organizes in the large upper room. There are worship services that happen there, probably in the 1840s, but definitely by the 1860s, we know of worship services that happen there. And for that little office, there are some critical moments in the church that take place in that space. Some that make us cringe, but others that make us pretty happy. That's where the last blessing that we know of that Joseph gave his son to follow him into church leadership. So that took place there in the Red Brick Store. Some of the other activities that I think of, 1848, Joseph III is a fairly young teenager, and his mother and stepfather decide that he needs to get some experience as a shopkeeper. And so he makes a stab at running the store downstairs. He doesn't do a very good job, but one of the responsibilities of the shopkeeper is to guard the store overnight, so he's sleeping upstairs. And in his memoirs, he writes about waking up in the middle of the night to this incredibly bright light. It's so bright that it disorients him, and he runs into a wall as he's trying to make his way to the larger room, to the windows. He looks out the windows, and he sees that the temple is on fire. He leaves the store, goes up the street about a block, and he stays with Emma. He wants to make sure his mom is safe because he is rightly afraid that an arsonist has set fire to the temple. Is somebody going to come after my mother next? So he stays with his mother. His stepfather is part of the team that heads up the hill and tries to extinguish the fire. But that's a pretty significant moment in Joseph's childhood that takes place right there in the Red Brick Store. In his early adulthood, as he's beginning his leadership with the church, a little branch organizes there in Nauvoo. And at first they're meeting in homes, but eventually they grow big enough that they decide to use that upper room in the store. They call themselves the Olive Branch. And if you think back to the earliest church seals, kind of the logo for the church, you see an olive branch on there signifying the peace focus that they're looking into. And this is an interesting little branch. So Joseph Smith is president of the church, but he's also pastor or presiding elder of this branch. So he's getting some on-ground congregational leadership as he's president of the church in this little building. And Alexander, his brother, receives his first priesthood call in the upper room of the Red Brick Store. The story is something along the lines, the priesthood were gathering there in the upper room, praying over the needs of the congregation, and they recognized that they needed, a teacher, the office of teacher, and several of them ended up speaking to Alexander being a good person to fill that role. And Alexander doesn't want anything to do with that. He gets up and stands, and he gives this wonderfully long speech about how he's the worst person in the world to have any kind of priesthood office. He doesn't want it. And besides, I'm a terrible preacher. And one of the brothers gets up and says, well, you've just been preaching so well for the past 5 minutes. And he eventually accepts that priesthood role. And Alexander would eventually go on to have the role that his grandfather had as patriarch or evangelist of the church in the later part of the 1800s and up to his last years of life. So some really significant moments happening in the upper room. So it's taken down 1890, as I mentioned. It sits an open lot until the 1970s. 1972, it's the focus of the summer archaeologic dig. And the decision's made that this building is historically significant enough that we really need to rebuild it. And I believe it's 11 families that they talk to financially support this building project. And they fund it, they get the building up, and by 1980, at the centennial of the founding of the movement, the Red Brick Store is once again part of the historic site, and tours go in there. It's not until, 1992, that the gift shop
opens downstairs. So prior to that, it had just been used for tourism and for educational purposes. But then today, we do use it for a huge variety of different things. Of course, the gift shop downstairs, but then tours end upstairs. We have classes that are held upstairs. There are occasional community activities that are held up there. One of our longtime volunteers, he's a magician, and for many years he would put on a magic show in the Redbrook store, and that was always a lot of fun. It would bring people from the community to experience the Redbrook store. And then in 2018, over the summer, that was the year we were recognizing the centennial of the historic site, we decided to have weekly Sunday evening gatherings. So we revived the Olive Branch. And there were not many priesthood members amongst our staff that particular summer, so it fell on me largely to do a lot of that. But John Charles Duffy, who's some of the listeners might be familiar with, he and I worked together to put together those weekly worship services. And it was an interesting experience for me. I'd been a part of pretty traditional Community of Christ congregations, but to post invitations in the general store downstairs to the general public to just, hey, we're having this Sunday night. Here's the topic we're talking about. You're welcome to show up. So we would never know who is showing up, what Latter-day Saint tradition they're coming from. We had no idea how many to expect on a given Sunday evening. The group of summer students that year was pretty mixed when it came to faith. And so sometimes they would show up, sometimes they wouldn't, but it was an interesting experience. And right at the end of that summer, I had been talked into holding a communion service as our close to the summer series. I did not want to do that, but I caved to, well, a couple of apostles that some of the listeners might be familiar with. Actually talked me into doing it. And I went into that service pretty nervous. I was still a fairly new priest at that point. This was my third time serving communion, and I was in charge of the entire service. John Charles had gone back home by that point, and so I was pretty well on my own for this. And we hadn't had a lot of success with our advertising to get just random walk-ins who had taken tours that Sunday to show up that Sunday evening. Well, we had people show up that evening, and for this service that I did not really want to do, I had two LDS men and one restorationist man who showed up for this communion service that I was completely in charge of. It was interesting. I'm not sure I'm ready to tackle something like that again completely by myself, but I'm glad I was pushed to do that, even though I really didn't want to.
Well, in the tradition of Alexander, being pushed into it, even though you didn't want to, that's an appropriate place to have that happen and to share in his legacy of capitulating to those who get us to go a little bit outside of our comfort zone. So yep, that's a good experience to share. Thank you. So I wanted to just briefly give you an opportunity to say something about the kind of the lesser known structures at this site. You said that several are used for guests or for other purposes, including staff housing. Do you have a favorite among them or an interesting story from one of the lesser known buildings on the site?
Since I haven't spent a lot of time looking at stories to some of those lesser known structures, I can't say that I can report on a lot that are strictly history. This is where we get into some of my fun on site, because we venture into some of the folklore that's here. And so stories that there might be an element of history to them, but they're not well documented. But one of which that is fairly well documented, three houses down from the Redbrook store is the Wright House. And that's one that has had a lot of remodeling done over recent years. We had an incredibly generous donor who helped us with that renovation project. And it's one that we hope to be able to rent to visitors to the area that not only will give visitors a chance to experience living in the historic site, but it'll help bring a little income to the historic site, which is always a benefit for us. But one of the stories with this house is that during Joseph Jr.'s lifetime, there's one of the many moments that he needs to escape arrest, and he borrows a boat from the Wright family. The boat has a leak in it, but he needs to get out of town, and so they put the boat in the Mississippi River, which is just across the street from this particular house. And the story goes that the men had to bail the boat out with their shoes or their boots as they were rowing across the river on this particular evening. So it's stories like that. There's great documentation with that one, but there are other stories that are a lot of fun to tell, but maybe aren't the most historical. I think the one that I feel the safest sharing so that it doesn't get out of hand, it's a mixture of both history and folklore, and it's a Lewis Biedemann story, so that's always fun. Not a lesser known structure because it would be the Mansion House, but when he's early in his marriage with Emma and they're living in the Mansion House, when guests would stay there, because they're running it as a hotel, he would tell them about secret tunnels that Joseph Smith had dug from the family homes there on the flats up to the temple. And he told so many people this story that it spread. Well, we know he's telling this story. That's pretty well documented. But we're also pretty confident, just knowing the stories of Lewis Biedemann, an insight to his character, that he is completely making this story up. But he's still telling the story, and it persists to this day. Occasionally, you will have people show up on site and ask, what about the secret tunnels that went from the Mansion House up to the temple? And you're like, well, let me tell you about Lewis Biedemann. So it's a great story that he is intentionally creating folklore for the Nauvoo community. And like I said, the story comes up every now and then.
Oh, that's wonderful.
There are all sorts of stories that are along those lines that I wish I had more time to be able to puzzle them out and find the truth, the history that's in them, because they're great stories to tell, but I'm hesitant to tell them without getting myself into trouble or spreading rumors.
So you've done a great job, Wendy, of sharing about the site itself, and I am encouraging our listeners to watch your entire lecture. But I wanted to ask you before we close, you've worked with historic sites for some time, Kirtland, and then here in Nauvoo. How has this journey with kind of the history of the church informed your own personal journey of discipleship?
I've had some incredible mentors in my life, especially when I was a teenager, as I was growing into understanding what my own priesthood journey was going. I know discipleship and priesthood are not interchangeable, but for my discipleship, that included recognizing as a teenager that I did have priesthood calling in my life. And to have these mentors around me when I was a teenager was great. But then when I think about a lot of the development that I've gone through in recent years, it's completely from my time here in Nauvoo and my time in Kirtland, learning the patience that you have got to have when you're on your discipleship journey, both with yourself and with the people that are around you, because you never know who you might be inadvertently mentoring. I think about how much I've had to learn to remain calm under pressure, because especially here in Nauvoo, I had a few experiences in Kirtland, but more so here in Nauvoo, situations where I've had to keep myself really calm because there's a guest that's maybe making me really irritated with the questions that they keep pushing. And I know that it's the training that I've had here that I'm able to keep my temper under control and carry on and helping them with where they're at and the information that they want, but without letting things get out of hand. And I haven't spent a lot of time in Plano, Illinois, which is about 4.5 hours from here. But the last time I left Plano, I recognized that I had lost an opportunity that I should have taken while I was there. And as I looked back on some of the stories in our larger church history, I see that there are so many choices that whether they were made or not made, whether they turned out to be the right choice or not, but we've had to just carry on and do the best we can with the decisions that were made. And if a wrong took place because of those decisions, then we need to do our best to face it and resolve it as best we can. There's just so much practical discipleship that I have picked up, especially around the full-time staff that I have the wonderful opportunity to work with, and then the volunteers that have been in and out of the sites that I've gotten to meet and gotten to know. It's been a remarkable experience to have spent so much time and not have intended back in 2006 to end up spending so much time with church history.
Well, it's been wonderful to listen to you share some of your expertise and what you've learned in working with church history. In your in the notes from your lecture, you wrote that Community of Christ Historic Sites Foundation has a tagline of "Your story is church history," and we know that's true. Generations of people have family history that is built into the properties that Emma held onto for the family and that became part of the church historic sites. But countless others have history associated with or shaped by the historic sites, the buildings there, the legacy, the stories behind them. And you write that you are inviting folks to share their family stories to help continue to build the histories of not just the site there at Nauvoo, but the site at Kirtland, Plano Stone Church, and Liberty Hall. And so if you have listeners, family stories that contribute to the histories of those sites, Wendy would love to hear them as she lives out that tagline, "Your story is church history." So before we bring our episode to a close, Wendy, do you have anything, any closing thought or anecdotal story that you'd like to share before we wrap it up?
I could probably go on for a very long time with all the different stories that I've accumulated over my years with the historic sites, but don't get the chance to share all the time. But you've just said so well what I wanted to push, that our stories are so important. And when I was doing this initial work, this has been a multiple year project for me. I started this research back in 2017 in preparation for our centennial. And a summer student from the 1960s, I think 1964, Lee Updike, reached out to me back in 2018 and said, "I'm coming to Nauvoo. I want to talk to you about my time as an intern." And so he and I talked back and forth. I can't remember exactly what happened, but I was not able to give him his tour. I don't remember what it was, but he emailed me all the different stories he wanted to share. And it was a wonderful insight to what it was like for a student in 1964, of what it was like giving tours here at that time. And it's such a very different experience than what I have as an intern. And so it's so important to preserve those stories. So again, if people have experiences with the historic sites, whether they were summer interns or they have family connections here, I really would love to hear those stories and help preserve them for the future of the historic sites.
Thank you so much, Wendy. And so listeners, you can contact Wendy at weaton, that's W-E-A-T-O-N, at seeofchrist.org. And if you would like to listen to and see the wonderful photographs that
Wendy shares in her lecture, and I would encourage you to do so, then you can go to historicsitesfoundation.org and click on the summer lecture series. So if you have additional comments or questions, Wendy would love to hear them along with your history stories. This has been Cup of Joe, part of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Karen Peter. Thanks to Wendy Eaton, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.